Hello, I'm Vershawn Young, host of New Books in African American Studies, the interview series where writers and scholars of African American arts, culture, life, literature, politics, and sciences discuss their new books. Today, I had the opportunity to speak with Mariam Thagard about her new book, Images of Black Modernism, Verbal and Visual Strategies of the Harlem Renaissance. This book examines the intersecting contributions of writers and visual artists during a key period in African-American cultural history. Of course, that key period is the Harlem Renaissance, and this book is a goldmine for anyone interested in that era. It also gives much to those interested in the concept of modernism, especially as it applies to such authors as Zora Neale Hurston, Nella Larsen, James Weldon Johnson, George Schuyler, and even Carl Van Vechten, whom she also analyzes as a visual artist. Other visual artists she discusses are Aaron Siskin and James Van Der Zee. Mariam gives us much information about what went into writing Images of Black Modernism, and it is a delight to hear. Let's listen in.
Hello, Mariam.
Hi, Vershawn. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for asking. Today, we're talking to Mariam Thagard, the author of Images of Black Modernism, Verbal and Visual Strategies of the Harlem Renaissance, published by University of Massachusetts Press in 2010. I've read this book and can say with certainty that Thagard's study is an exceptional contribution to the discussion of both modernism and the Harlem Renaissance. It is particularly invaluable because it explores the techniques, devices, and politics of modernism as a literary and cultural concept, and it teases out both the distinctions and cross-influences of white modernism and black modernism. Thagard also brings together writers and visual artists such as Nella Larsen and Carl Van Vechten, James Weldon Johnson, and James Van Der Zee. There is much to glean from this well-written and meticulously researched study, and I'm delighted to have Mariam on the show today to discuss her book. Mariam, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. First, I want to thank you for inviting me to talk about the book. I'm an associate professor of English and African American Studies at the University of Iowa. I had a job previously at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and I grew up in Louisiana. I wanted to say a few words about my name because people looking at the cover of the book might think my first name is Mariam, but as your listeners just heard, my first name is pronounced Mariam. I was named after Mariam Makeba, the South African singer. A lot of people may know her because of her marriage to Sophie Carmichael in the 1960s. But I grew up in Louisiana and went to school in Massachusetts and also in the Bay Area at UC Berkeley.
Nice. Mariam Makeba was also friends with Nina Simone. Is that right?
You know, actually, I'm not sure. I know that she was good friends with Paul Simon, as well as the African-American actor whose name escapes me right now, but he was in Carmen Jones. And she was very popular in the 1960s and still is in some circles.
That's right. I think that actor is Harry Belafonte.
Right, Harry Belafonte.
Yes. All righty. Mariam, can you begin by telling us how you came to write Images of Black Modernism?
Yes, the book is a result of my long fascination with the 1920s, and in particular with the Harlem Renaissance. I've always been curious and interested in the writers and artists and intellectuals of that particular period. In the book, I look at the relationship between languages and images, the ways in which languages and images work together to construct stereotypes of African Americans, and conversely, how writers, artists, and intellectuals of the 1920s used that relationship to deconstruct those stereotypes, to rupture the way in which certain stereotypes of African Americans are traditionally presented in American culture. So I look first at James Weldon Johnson and his really seminal essay on African American poetry, which he published in the Book of American Negro Poetry in 1922. And I look at his critique of Negro or Black dialect. And I continue by looking at the works of Noah Larson, George Schuyler, and Carl Van Vechten. And I conclude the book by examining a really fascinating exhibition that was held in 1969 at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. The exhibition was called Harlem on My Mind. And throughout the book, I explore this dynamic between words and image, the way in which they work together to create certain ideas about African Americans in American culture.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk specifically about the chapters in the book, because you do such a wonderful job highlighting some of the politics and debates that the artistic work responded to and also sparked. But I want to ask up front if you could define for the listeners some of the terms, the central terms that your book revolve around. I think one of those terms would be, is in the title, modernism. And a term that you also use in the book in certain places is imagism. Can you talk to us about how those terms relate to this study?
Well, I think I was somewhat hesitant to offer a very concrete or didactic definition of modernism because the way I envision modernism, it's more of a sense, a sensory experience. Dealing with language and images and other forms of art. So in some ways, my conception of modernism is very abstract, and I recognize it in the ways in which certain artists and writers experiment with language and images to create this idea of African Americans and of the African American experience. So I think the readers of the book may be hard pressed to find that one sentence definition or description of modernism or Black modernism. But in some ways, that's very deliberate because I think there's something expansive about Black modernism that is recognizable, but it's hard to pin down. It's hard to place into concrete, definitive forms. And in fact, this is a basic argument of one of the chapters, the chapter on James Weldon Johnson, mm-hmm. where I talk about Black dialect and the Black sermons and Black spirituals and how difficult it was for editors and compilers of the spirituals to place the spirituals into print. Mm-hmm. There was something about Black music that really resisted the attempt to place it into this written, printed version. And I think in a lot of ways that is very parallel to this whole idea of Black modernism. We know it when we see it. There's something very exciting and energizing about it. But how do you actually quantify it or capture it in this written textual form?
Mm-hmm.
And the argument I make about Black dialect, I think, is really central to the book. I look at how Johnson critiques Black dialect, the way it's been represented on the printed page. You know, most readers of Negro or Black dialect will recognize it in the form of misspelled words, incorrect grammar, malapropisms. And Johnson was very critical of this because he suggested that the way Black dialect is represented actually conjures up an image of the Black body that is itself very negative and stereotypical. He gives the idea of the black guy like giving an image of the Negro in front of the cabin, banjo playing and shuffling. And Johnson argued that black dialect, as it's represented in the year of 1922, needs to be changed, that there needs to be a new way of representing black language. And this language may be less picturesque, meaning it may be less pleasurable to the white reader, but it's necessary in order to more accurately represent this new Negro that is becoming well known in the North, and especially in New York. So I look at this particular passage in the Book of American Negro Poetry written by Johnson and analyze how it actually offers a very concise conception of changing, of representing black language that changed the image of African Americans. And that writing will have to be less picturesque, less pleasing, but by doing so, you can actually move, or he argues that you can move African American literature forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the remaining chapters of the book try to examine how various artists took up that call and presented this less picturesque image of African Americans.
And I want to talk about those in particular in just a moment, but I want to slow down and ask about that other term, imagism, because it seems really related to what you just said.
Yes, imagism. Your listeners may be familiar with that term through Ezra Pound, a very important and significant poet in the early 20th century. And imagism, I feel one element of imagism is to make poetry concrete, that when you write a poem, the words that you use, the way the poem is written, you should use very concise language to represent the object. So there is a sort of shortness or conciseness to the imagistic poem. When I talk about imagism in the book, I actually bring up Zora Neale Hurston, who I think is sort of revising this idea of imagism. Her idea of imagism, I argue, is much more expansive. It's much more decorative. So whereas someone like Pound might argue for the sort of short, very concise, poetic form, someone like Hurston really enjoys decorating the poem or decorating language. So Hurston has this really fascinating description of the African American's home,
mm-hmm.
and she describes it as all kind of pictures on the wall, and the couch is covered with very decorative covers. Just a lot of images surround or in the room. And I think it's a really good metaphor of how Hurston envisions imagism as this much more visually engaging type of writing.
Let's talk about some of the other ways that authors employ modernism. Nella Larsen, for instance, in the second chapter, and you focus quite a bit of attention on her novel Passing.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us how she fits into this discussion of black modernism?
Yes. I look at Larsen's Passing, her second novel, and I have to say, you asked me earlier how I got interested in the Harlem Renaissance, and Really, it was through Noah Larson. A professor recommended that I read Quicksand. And after reading it, I was just struck by Larson's depiction of this intelligent African-American woman, an intelligent African-American woman who reads books and has a teaching job. And I just found that image quite fascinating. In passing, her second novel, she looks at a light-skinned woman who passes as white and is reacquainted with a childhood friend who is also light-skinned but maintains an African-American identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the first woman, Claire, who's passing, tries to insert herself into Irene, the second woman, into Irene's black life. One of the really interesting elements of the novel is Larson's keen use of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
She has these very descriptive passages in which she talks about the two characters' clothes. So we have one passage where, you know, Claire is wearing this very odd blue and brown dress that manages to match the decorations in the room. And we have Irene, who is very attuned to the fashion choices of Claire. And I suggest in that chapter that there's something very important about the way dress and clothing is used in a novel. It's used in a way to enable Irene and Claire to adopt a white identity at certain moments. For Claire, you know, she adopts a white identity constantly or continually because she's married to a white man and she hasn't informed him of her black heritage. And Irene passes at certain moments when it would be inconvenient to be known as a black person. And I argue that their fashion choices really enable them to create a convincing passing performance, that their clothing choices help create in the viewer or the spectator the sense that they're more white than they are black.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very subtle argument in the sense that there is a class component, I think, to clothing and fashion. And it's a class component that Larson was aware of, and I think her readers would have been aware of, that dressing in a certain way will place you in one particular class rather than another. And that Irene and Claire, as astute readers of fashion, would be aware of this, and that they dress their bodies in a way so that they can be perceived as members of a higher class or members of the white population rather than an African-American population. And, of course, embedded in this argument is this whole sense that, you know, having a white skin may enable you to have better economic or social opportunities. I think that was definitely an idea or an assumption among some African Americans in the early 20th century. You could see that in the sense in which there's a concern about skin color, and having a certain skin color may have you know, open certain doors for you if you're African American. Of course, it's an argument that is highly criticized, and rightly so, in this day and age. But I think in the early 20th century, unfortunately, there was this assumption that, you know, having a particular skin color equated with a certain social class and educational.
I think one of the brilliant things that you uncover in this chapter, when you talk about the passing, Nella Larsen, and you have some mention of Johnson's autobiography of an ex-colored man, is the way in which performance itself was integral to the passing character, that it wasn't just having optically white skin that allowed them to pass. But as you just illuminated, I think that part of that passing entailed a certain kind of visual performance.
Right. And I look at the whole idea of social etiquette, of acting in a certain way in social settings, and actually quote one of the earliest etiquette manuals for African Americans that was published in 1920. And there are actually several manuals like this that try to instruct African Americans on, you know, how to act at a social gathering, how to act when you're on the street and you meet someone of the opposite sex.
Mm-hmm.
There was this very conscientious desire to instruct black people on the best way to perform or the best way to act when you're out in public. I think, you know, you could argue that one of the earliest etiquette manuals for black people was Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery,
mm-hmm.
where you could see how he's trying to educate newly freed slaves on how to be a good citizen, how to be a good American. And I think some of that trickles down even to the early 20th century, where you see these manual writers being really concerned about how African Americans are perceived in a public space, that they have to act in a good and proper fashion so that they will reflect positively upon their race.
Mm-hmm. And people interested in African American literature, especially in this period, will probably be familiar, as you mentioned, with Nella Larsen's passing and with the ambiguous ending which you write about. I want to ask you a question about that ambiguous ending, because in one part of the discussion, you offer a speculative question: what would have happened had Claire not fallen out of the window?
Mm-hmm.
And you say that your position on that ending is that Irene pushes Claire out the window. If I remember the ending correctly, it's both Irene and Claire's husband, John Bellew, at the window with Claire. And so it would seem that both of them are responsible for her death.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment. And I always have these really good debates and discussions with my students when I teach this novel about that particular ending. I think I was a little bit undecided myself about who actually pushes her or if she falls out of the window.
Mm-hmm.
I did explore the various implications, you know, if Irene was the one to push her out. I think it demonstrates just how nervous and anxious she was about Claire maintaining a presence in her life. And then, of course, there's also the possibility that it's Claire's white husband,
mm-hmm.
John Bellew, who pushes her out the window, which is another possible reading, because John Bellew sees Claire in this party with African Americans and finally figures out that she may, in fact, be African American. I think one of the more curious possibilities is if Claire herself falls out the window through her own agency, because then that would suggest that Claire is concerned about being found out, that she doesn't want to be discovered for her passing performance. And I think, you know, regardless of which ending you decide to go with as the reader, there's something about that ambiguity that is important in and of itself. There's something by refusing to give this sort of concrete, definitive answer or definitive ending, I think that ending is modernistic in the way in which, you know, it leaves it up to the reader to make that sort of determination. And throughout the novel, Claire is this ambiguous figure. We don't really quite get into her mind. We don't know exactly what her motivations are. We don't know what she's thinking. And the fact that she is a sort of question mark, at the very beginning of the novel, I think is reflected in the way that the novel ends with, this question mark about how does she actually die? Does she, kill herself? Does she commit suicide? Or, is Irene or is John Bellew responsible for her death? In a way, that sort of very central question is reflective of the questions that the reader has about Claire throughout the book. And I just think there's something quite fascinating about not being able to pin down Claire, not being able to know her as this understandable or readily knowable figure that I think makes her so enchanting, both for the reader and for Irene. There's something very seductive about her inability to be pinned down into one type of figure or character.
Mm-hmm. In chapter 3, you talk about George Schuyler's satirical novel, Black No More, and his essay, The Negro Art, Hokum. Mm-hmm. Why Schuyler?
Several people have asked me that. And in fact, one of the readers, external readers of the book, suggested that I eliminate that chapter. I've always been fascinated with Schuyler. He is a very interesting, polemical figure. He is prone to controversy,
mm-hmm.
and sort of invites controversies, and in that he's very different from a lot of the more well-known figures of the Harlem Renaissance. And I think Black No More is an undeservedly overlooked book.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason why I included the chapter. It's a very perceptive reading of how race operates in American culture, especially in the American political system. The book is about a doctor who creates this process of making African Americans white. And it's a process that African Americans can do voluntarily. And in fact, so many African Americans do it so that by the end of the novel, African Americans cease to exist in a large number. And Schuyler explores how the absence of black people really damages the American political system, that Republicans and Democrats really need racial difference in order to establish themselves with the American public.
Mm-hmm.
And in the absence of that difference, it's difficult to find the topics or the issues that will garner votes to win a major election like the presidency. So I think it's a very keen reading of how race operates in American culture, how there are certain groups that depend upon the controversies and divisions that race sometimes creates in the American public. And I admire, I don't agree with all of Schuyler's political ideas and thoughts. He was actually very conservative by the end of his life. But I do admire his willingness to spark debate and be the sort of lightning rod for various groups who wanted to critique American politics and the American social system. There's something quite admirable in his willingness to do that. Even though I think a lot of people are critical of his political stance. But but it's a really, it's a funny book. It's a satire. And I think readers will, you know, find a lot of humor in some of the situations he recounts. Say, for example, there's a really funny passage where the main character, Max, has just finished the process and he's now white. And he goes into a white club and he watches a white couple dancing. And Max thinks to himself, well, they don't really dance very well. They sort of lumber around. They can't move gracefully like African Americans. And Skylar here is, you know, playing with the whole idea that African Americans know how to dance, that they dance better than white people.
Mm-hmm.
And for Max, it's a moment in which he realizes, well, maybe it's not quite a good thing to be white. Maybe being white doesn't automatically equate with wealth and prestige. Maybe there is something quite special about being an African American. And so throughout the book, Skylar sort of questions the stereotypes people have about black people, as well as the stereotypes blacks may have about whites. I think when it's taught in class, it really, it makes students laugh because I think they recognize some of the stereotypes that are presented in the book. They recognize it in today's culture, and I think perhaps they may even realize that they themselves have those kinds of stereotypes, say, about dancing and black athletes. So it's a really good book to get students to question their assumptions about race and the ideas that one particular race is better at doing something than the other one. And it just presents it in a very humorous fashion, you know, in a way in which it keeps students from, you know, sort of clamming up about this usually sensitive topic, race.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy that you decided to ultimately include the chapter in the book for the reason that you state in the chapter. You say that Skylar is important to a discussion of black modernism because of his decided views on black representation in art and his disruption of the commonly held equation between blackness and the body. It does seem, however, that Skylar stumbles over some of his own ideas in the book, at least to me, especially when he talks about the Negro dialect, which is, you said, is central to your study. And he says that everybody knows that, you know, there's no difference between quote unquote Negro speech and white people's speech in the South or any other region. I always found that somewhat odd, a statement. But perhaps you have a different take on that. Maybe you think that he's disrupting that categorical distinction between black and white language.
Well, I think a really good way to answer that question is to look at his essay, The Negro Art Hokum,
mm-hmm.
Where he makes the statement that the Afro-American, and it's a version of the term Afro-American, the Afro-American is just a lamp black Anglo-Saxon. And it's a problematic statement because it suggests that the African-American is just this darkened version of a white person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a problematic statement because he really downplays the cultural contributions African Americans have made in terms of language, in terms of the social experience or culture that African Americans have contributed to American culture. And I think, you know, there are parts of that essay as well as parts of Black No More that a lot of readers have found troubling, precisely because he doesn't give a lot of weight to the different experience African Americans have had in this country that, you know, were different than the experiences of white Americans. Nor does he account for how the experience of slavery really shaped some of black expressive culture. And there was a response to Tyler's essay, Negro Art Hokum, written by Langston Hughes. And Hughes's response does a really good job of capturing what was unique about black culture and you know, what was special about it in a way that Schuyler doesn't acknowledge. So I think a lot of readers have shared your concern and have found some resolution in Langston Hughes's response. And I also suggest when people you know, make that remark about how Schuyler is troubling, I also direct them to Ralph Ellison's essay, What America Would Be Like Without Blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And the title itself indicates how it's relevant to the book Black No More, in which you know, African Americans cease to exist in large numbers. But Ellison, in that essay, makes a very powerful and provocative argument about how black people contributed to the language, the style, the quote-unquote soul of America. He calls black contributions the swing of American
mm-hmm.
life, you know, the soul of American life. And I think it's a very beautiful and powerful response to something like the Negro Art Hokum that disavows the very distinct and unique experiences African Americans have had in this country and how that experience has been translated into black expressive culture.
We're right at the middle of the book, and in the next chapters you transition into talking about the actual visuality during the period and such people as Van Vechten and Van Der Zee. I think this would be a good time to ask you to read something from the book for us.
Sure. I'd like to read a passage from the conclusion in which I talk about the Metropolitan's exhibition, Harlem on My Mind. It's a passage that highlights some of the questions and concerns I had with this particular exhibit.
Okay.
37 years after the publication of Infants of the Spring, the front pages of major New York newspapers rearticulated the questions that infused the Harlem Renaissance. The art exhibition, Harlem on My Mind, the Cultural Capital of Black America, 1900 through 1968, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, from January 18th to April 6th, 1969, reflects the late 20th century contentiousness about how to represent and market the Harlem Renaissance. The exhibit itself functions as an artifact, an event that, in an effort to celebrate the city's past, cannot be divorced from the aesthetic debates about black representation in the 1920s or from the racial politics of the 1960s. Like the literary anthology, a museum exhibition requires deliberate choices. It confers value, or, quote, cultural capital, on the artist included. An exhibition tells a story, and its location within a privileged institutional space, such as a museum, influences how the exhibition's arts and artifacts are perceived and remembered. Writing of the aesthetic and political purposes of the museum in Western culture, Carol Duncan notes how the museum space both reflects the power of the nation state and fashions the nation's citizens. In 1969, the Metropolitan Museum of Art reflected Harlem's past in its historic and artistically significant galleries. By devoting such space to Harlem, the Metropolitan, or at least the exhibition's decision makers, appear to acknowledge the role that Harlem and its inhabitants played in one of the great cities in the United States. Why would a display riddled with charges of racism, anti-Semitism, and paternalism that had limited input from African-American scholars and artists, that inspired an anonymous patron to deface one of the Metropolitan's paintings by Rembrandt, an exhibit that, even before it opened, offended numerous New Yorkers, including African-Americans, Jewish-Americans, Latinos, the mayor of New York City, and New York art patrons. Why is such an exhibit instructive of the problematic remembering process and an example of an unsuccessful weaving of image and text? Harlem on My Mind reproduced some of the most divisive issues of the Harlem Renaissance. For example, the questions of white patronage, the qualities that signified art, and the best way to represent African Americans. The exhibit became a microcosm of the debates that defined Black Harlem in the 1920s and the 1930s, and it mirrored the concerns that continue to influence Harlem's portrayal. The Metropolitan's Harlem on My Mind celebrated Harlem, yet it did so by focusing heavily on photography. The exhibition quite literally staged its narrative through a juxtaposition of image and text, a contest between pictures and words. In addition to photographs by such artists as Aaron Siskind and Gordon Parks, the exhibit consisted primarily of enlarged photographs by James Van Der Zee and reprints from New York area newspapers. And because the event took place after a highly charged moment of racial crisis in New York City's history, it resurrected the too familiar binary of art or propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
The exhibit's textual counterpart, a catalog published by Random House, demonstrated in particular the problems surrounding the textual commemoration of Harlem. I'm concerned not so much with the actual exhibit as I am with the controversies and aesthetic discussions it engendered and the exhibition's reception by both Harlemites and notable reviewers. The exhibit was noteworthy not only for the controversy surrounding it, but also for the skill it displayed in marketing for popular consumption an idea of the Harlem Renaissance. The exhibition's presentation of the period, as well as the battle over what Harlem is and how it should be represented, instructs us about how this space functions in American culture, who, if anyone, owns it, and the tension between the visual and the written, image and text that continues to influence contemporary portrayals of Black culture. What is the cultural capital of Harlem, and who gets to define it? What are the images Harlem and its Renaissance evoke, and why? Examining the Metropolitan's attempt to refashion the Renaissance offers a timeless lesson on the construction and appropriation of Harlem's commodifiable history and about a place that continually reflects an early paradigmatic Black modern moment.
Very nice. It exemplifies the how well written this book is.
Oh, thank you.
You talk in chapter 4 about Van Vechten's photography, about his visual collections, and about his controversial novel Nigger Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that title?
I have mixed feelings about the title. Van Vechten told his friends that he deliberately wanted a title that would spark interest, spark discussion, and he definitely did that. And of course, the title itself refers to how Harlem is geographically located above downtown New York. So the Black space of Harlem sort of overlooks the white area of Harlem. I don't think the title was necessary, but I understand why he did it, and there were a number of people who were disappointed with the title, particularly the poet County Cullen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the title was necessary, but I think it did exactly what Van Vechten wanted. It made the book popular, and a lot of people read it. It was the best-selling book of the period. Went through numerous editions, and I think it demonstrates Van Vechten's marketing skill. I think he was a great marketer, and so in that sense, the title was quite a good marketing strategy for him.
You include a number of photographs from Carl Van Vechten's Yale collection.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very striking. Can you talk to us about those?
Yeah, the images in the book come from Ben Becton's Photographs of Blacks. And it's a very extensive collection of photographic images that Ben Becton took of both black celebrities and everyday African-Americans, say, for example, his maid. Just images that he took of African-Americans. And one of the most photographed person is Ethel Waters, who is another overlooked figure of the period. But in the book, I have images of Billie Holiday holding this African mask. And that mask actually reappears in several of Ben Becton's photographs. And I was just really curious about how the mask was used and presented in various images. In the book, I, in particular, highlight the use of the mask with Billie Holiday, the well-known African-American singer. And I think it's the first image of Billie Holiday holding the mask. She has it close up to her face, and her eyebrow is kind of arched, and she's looking at the viewer or the photographer with a sort of amused expression, just sort of wondering what the viewer or the spectator may be thinking. And I just think it's a very evocative image, a very questioning image of what blackness may represent to a white viewer in particular. And it's curious to me because the image that Ben Becton takes of Billie Holiday seems to echo another famous image of a white woman holding an African mask next to her face. And I have images of that particular white woman also in the photograph. Also in the book for comparison. And I just think it's the way that the mask is used in the series of photographs by Ben Becton just highlights the idea that there's a sort of commodifiable, a knowable idea of blackness. And I think Ben Becton in his photograph is very ironically trying to portray that. So one of the arguments I make in that chapter is that whereas Ben Becton stated that the title of his book was meant ironically and that there are certain ironic moments in his novel, I think he's actually more successful in ironizing blackness and what people conceive of blackness in his photograph because of the way some of the subjects are represented or posed. So in contrast to the book, which I think, for a lot of black readers was not ironic and it was not a parody of black life, I think his photographs are much more successful in capturing the sort of ironic attitude about black culture.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Another argument I make in that chapter is that the collection that Ben Becton created at Yale, a collection he named after James Weldon Johnson, I argue that it's a very important and significant collection of black arts and letters, and that a lot of people are critical of Ben Becton and his role in the Harlem Renaissance. But I suggest that regardless of what you think about his book or about his role, you do have to credit him for creating and devising this really pivotal collection of black life and black art at Yale University.
In the fifth chapter, you have a very provocative and somewhat curious quote that you begin the book with by Roland Barthes. I have a disease. I see language. I found that really interesting. In this chapter, you talk about the photography of James Van Der Zee and Aaron Siskind.
Mm-hmm.
Why that epigraph, and how does it relate to your discussion?
You know, I think that there's something very visual in language. I think that language is not just this a textual form or a written form. It's not just a verbal form of communication. I think there's something very imagistic in language, and that's sort of the argument that underlies the whole book, that within language and the words that we use, we're constructing or creating visual images in our mind, these mental images that shape how we see people. And so when I came across that particular quote by Barthes, I just thought it was perfect for this particular chapter because, language is something you not only read or hear, it's also something that you see, and it's language is, something that visually makes these images in your mind. So it's a sensory experience that relates to not just hearing but also seeing. So you can see language, you can envision language. Barthes calls it a disease. I don't think it's a disease, but a very creative and important way of viewing the world.
Wow. Mariam, it has been a pleasure listening to you talk about your book, Images of Black Modernism, Verbal and Visual Strategies of the Harlem Renaissance. I bet your students are always thoroughly engaged and fascinated by what you present in class. I know that I was very fascinated and engaged in this book, which I have added to my syllabus for the spring.
Okay.
What are you working on now?
Right now I'm doing something very different. I'm moving slightly away from the early 20th century and examining various forms of technology in the 19th century and how technology shaped perceptions of race in American culture. I'm highly interested in the railroad and the phonograph and how those two particular forms of technology destabilized Americans' conceptions of race. So say, for example, the railroad car in America, it was a highly regimented and regulated space of race. If you think about Plessy versus Ferguson and the Jim Crow cars,
mm-hmm.
If you were of a certain race or if you looked to be of a certain race rather than another, you were required to occupy a certain space in the railroad car. And I'm just curious about how technology really impacted what Americans defined as race and how Americans defined whiteness and blackness and even indeed what it meant to be an American. This new project I'm working on takes me away from the Harlem Renaissance, but again, I'm still interested in how various races are represented and constructed in American culture.
Thank you so much, Mariam, for joining us on New Books in African American Studies.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We've been listening to Mariam Thagard discuss her wonderful new book, Images of Black Modernism, Verbal and Visual Strategies of the Harlem Renaissance, published by the University of Massachusetts Press in 2010. If you haven't already, I encourage you to pick up this book, read it, and share it with others.